Welcome. Today is July 5th, 2011. And so we had three eclipses in the last month. We talked about that. Last one was July 1st. A lot of people busy getting married last weekend. Prince Albert of Monaco got married on the eclipse day. Kate Moss got married on the eclipse day, same day. Prince Albert got married about 5 o'clock. I was trying to find Kate Moss's time of marriage, but I couldn't find it. Albert got married at 5 o'clock. It was actually a gold day. It was moon with Venus. So, I mean, if you're thinking about marriage, those two planets together, ideal. Because moon is the emotions and the emotional outlook, the emotional receptiveness, and one's ability to get one's emotional needs met. And Venus is the planet of love, relationship, sensuality, sexuality, and reciprocation in love. So those two planets are particularly key in marriage. So to have them both together, ideal. And the sun was there as well. Oftentimes in Vedic astrology, the Indians consider the sun. You know, there are planets that are benefic and planets that are malefic. Planets that are benevolent and planets that are malevolent. Same idea. Good, bad. By nature. So what are the planets that would be benefic or benevolent by nature? Moon. We'll get to the sun. Jupiter. Moon, Jupiter, Venus, Mercury. Correct. Now, they qualify Mercury depending on who he's hanging out with, but those would be your benevolent or benefic planets. Your malevolent or malefic planets would be? Well, yeah, we'll get to the sun. Mars, Saturn, Rahu, and Ketu. Okay. So, in traditionally, in Vedic astrology, the sun is classed as a malefic or a malevolent planet. But now you put yourself in India, and you know what it's like in India, and you get a hot day in India, and it's 47 degrees Celsius, which is 100 and what Fahrenheit? 120 Fahrenheit, something like that. You know, then the sun is very much a malefic. But in the Western world, the sun is not really a malefic. We could see it, we would consider it more of a benefic. You know, we're happy to have it, generally speaking. So, I myself don't always consider the sun to be a malefic or malevolent influence. And it has, in doing astrology, I haven't seen the sun always to play out to be a negative. So, on Friday, July 1st, the sun was in Gemini along with Venus and Moon. So, depending again what house it owns. If a planet owns a negative house, then whether it's a benefic or a malefic planet, it will create havoc in a chart. So, I won't get into Albert's chart, but they should have consulted somebody. Let's just put it that way. Before they got married at 5 p.m. The next day, the Saturday, they did their council. How did they say?
Registry.
But they didn't call it registry. They called it like the council or something. Yeah, registry office. They did their legal marriage on the Friday at 5 p.m. They did their church wedding, liturgical ceremony on Saturday at 5 p.m. Exactly the same. The charts were identical in the sense that The moon had not moved. It was also a gold day again on Saturday. It still wasn't the best time of day for the wedding. Okay.
And what effect would the eclipse
have? Well, eclipse is a very negative situation because this was a partial solar eclipse, which occurred. It's the peak of the eclipse was 9:38 a.m. London time, Irish time, of that same day, Friday. So, you know, with an eclipse, you want to give a lot of leeway. And you don't really want to get married and do important things. And also, the day that the sun moves, which is called the Sankranti, when the sun moves into a different sign, changing from one sign to another about the middle of each month, there you're not supposed to do anything 8 hours before and 8 hours after. Now, you know, for the Western mind, that's a little hard to grasp. And we don't exactly live our life here like people do in India, where they got all the time in the world. You know, there's no such thing as time, really, for them. So, you know, that also is a day that you don't want to do anything on when the sun moves. So when there's an eclipse and there's a chance of anything that might create a problem in the business at hand, in this case marriage, it's not good. So it depends how it plays itself out. If it's a solar eclipse, although the wedding chart itself looked very, very good, I don't have it in front of me, in terms of their professional success, career success, financial success. Well, it did in some ways in terms of bringing money in. But both the 12th house had Saturn, and the second house had the 12th house had Saturn, and the second house had 6, 7, 8 had Rahu. 12, Saturn in 12th house can often bring bankruptcy and financial reversal. Rahu in the second house can mean heavy financial loss, and especially through theft. So, I mean, in Monaco, he's a prince with, I don't know how much money they have. I assume a lot. They've been operating there for a lot of years. Yeah, Monaco with the gambling and everything. Yeah. It's a very popular place. The wealthy among the wealthy go there. The billionaires go there. So, I don't think there would be a problem, but we'll have to see how it plays out. I had a couple, in fact, friends of ours, who got married, and we figured out a time for him, what he wanted. But I said, I wouldn't really recommend this chart because it's got Rahu and Mars together, Rahu and Saturn together in the 12th house. 12th house is the house of loss. But the 12th house is also the house of moksha, or liberation, which is loss of the body, giving up the body. So 12th house is also the house of giving or losing. So giving is voluntary loss. Losing is involuntary loss. So when you got a negative planet like Saturn or Rahu in the 12th house, you're going to lose big time. And these people just filed for bankruptcy. And they lost two houses that they owned. And bankrupt. Well, they didn't know the chart. And I told them at the time, I mean, this could be financial loss, but it's great spiritually. Right now, in their lives, spiritually, they're like on this level. They're just moving right along and doing very, very well. And so this loss is not, surprisingly, it's not really having much of an effect on them at all. Which is what, if you're in a spiritual state of mind, you're supposed to be able to roll with the punches. And certainly they are doing that. So, number one, I would not advise you to get married with Rahu or Saturn in the 12th house. That's number one. The way you can get around it, I mean, you could certainly chant mantras. That works. You can do yajnas, like sacred fire ceremonies. That works. You can wear gemstones. That works. But wearing a gemstone is more passive. Chanting a mantra is the best of them all, because that's active, proactive. And you're actually engaging yourself. You put the gemstone on and, you know, okay, work for me, you know. It's fine, and it's good, but it's not like chanting a mantra or sitting down and doing a fire sacrifice and chanting all the mantras and making the offerings and, you know, everything you do. That's even better. And the other way to do it, which it's not really, I've never seen it written anywhere, is you play into it. Is you know what the effect's going to be, so you go ahead and head it off at the pass by creating the effect yourself. So, for example, if you had Saturn in the 12th house, and theoretically you could lose a lot of money. So what you do then is you give a bunch of charity. You give a lot of money in charity. Or it doesn't have to be money necessarily. What you go and do for others. So there is your voluntary loss, giving, letting go of. And that can offset what the universe needs to take from you. You can reduce or neutralize or, what's the other word? Not sublimate, modify, transform the karma. You can transform it. So it doesn't have to get the worst of you. And if you're aware of what's going on, it works. Clindy and I have done it on some occasions, and it's worked. Okay. The other day, Clindy and I were driving to Bray, which is a town, for those of you who don't know. Well, this is going onto the website, so they wouldn't know. Lots of people listen to these podcasts. Yeah. Different places. And I was just kind of thinking out loud, and I was thinking about my childhood at the time. And I was thinking about Ireland, and I was thinking, well, would I have rather been brought up here in Ireland, or would I have rather been brought up in Regina, Saskatchewan, Canada, and in my childhood? And I was more or less thinking of weather patterns, because you know what it's like here. It's very wet and rainy and cloudy. And Regina is like unbelievably frigid and cold in the winter. It's one of the coldest places on earth. It's very cold. But we had a beautiful summer. Really, really warm and sunny and wonderful. Every summer you could count on. So thinking like that, I said, I rather would have been brought up in Regina than in Ireland in my childhood. So, kind of happy with that. And she's looking at me like I got two heads. I'm like, why is he talking about that? And we turn the corner, and there's this big sign in the window of a store. What is this corner called? Do you know? It just says you're going. Once you take the right, you go to Super Value. Super Quino, and you're right there. So over on the left, there's the big sign in the store. Regina Impressions.
Oh my God.
That's what it said. Of course, it was pronounced Regina Impressions, but it's spelled the same. So I was giving Regina Impressions an air of the sun. Regina Impressions. So, any stories, any experiences you want to share?
Don't all speak at once. All right. I've been reading this very nice book by my godbrother, The Proof of Vedic Culture's Global Existence. And it talks about where Vedic...
Stephen Knapp.
It talks about... He's a very scholarly guy, and he's done a lot of reading from got a lot of research material, and this really gives you a wonderful perspective of how Vedic culture is indeed the oldest culture, predating anything, everything, and that the oldest book existing on the planet is the Rig Veda, the first of the four Vedas. And anyway, he goes on and on about that. So I was just going to mention a couple things in here, particularly some Sanskrit roots, Sanskrit being the root of all languages. At least that's the theory. I believe it. And we'll look at some of that. But Kalindi wants me to tell you this story. So I will. many moons ago, maybe I should begin by saying Brahma is the creator within the universe. He creates all the diversity within the universe. And Brahma is a empowered soul. We can call him a demigod or a celestial being, a deva. He's not Vishnu Tattva. He's not God himself. He's a jiva like we are, a regular soul. So Brahma is a position that one can be promoted to. Like you can be promoted to become the mayor of the town. So Brahma is the creator of all the diversity within the universe. But he's a very high being. So Brahma has a lifetime of 100 years, celestial years, Brahma years, not our years, not solar years. And he has days, obviously. And at the a Brahma's day is a very, very long period of time, something like 3 trillion years. Or, no, four, let me think, no. 4 billion years is Brahma's day. So his lifetime is 100 years. So this was near the end of Brahma's day. And that means at the end of each day, when night appears for Brahma, there is a dissolution in the universe, a minor dissolution. The flood will come, and all of the creation will be removed and put into a state of limbo, suspended animation, during Brahma's night, which is equally as long as his day. And in the morning, everyone will be set back into motion in accordance with their karma. That's how it works. So, King Satyavrata, which means one who follows a vow of truth. Satya is truth and Vrata is vow. He had his kingdom and he had was taking a little bit of time out,
and doing austerities, penances, on the bank of the river Kritamala in India. And he was scooping up water like this, and he was making an offering. This is how they usually do it. They scoop up water with the two hands, and they let the water fall from their hands, and they say the mantra or the prayer as the water falls. So he scooped up some water, and in his palm, in the water, was a tiny little fish. Oh, here you go, my little friend. Put him back into the water. And the fish turned around, looked at him, and says, "My dear king, surely you're not going to put me back in the river with all these dangerous fish that are ready to swallow me up and eat me in one gulp?" No, of course not. So the king scooped him up and he put him into his water pot. And in the evening he returned to the palace and he kept him in the water pot overnight. Got up in the morning, looked in the water pot, and the fish had grown. And the king said, "Whoa, you've gotten quite big overnight." And the fish said to him, "My dear king, surely you're not going to keep me in this water pot. It is far too small for me. I've grown. You must put me in some place that is suitable." "Oh, yes, of course." So the king takes him outside. He dumps him down the well. Much greater. Almost instantly, the fish grows and he fills the well. "My dear king, surely you're not going to leave me down here because I've outgrown the well. You must put me in a place that will accommodate my size if you have any compassion." So the king fishes out the fish from the bottom of the well. Maybe he pulls up, I don't know. And he puts him in a pond. And almost instantly, the fish grows as big as the pond. "My dear king, surely you won't consign me to live in this pond, which is too small for me. Why don't you put me someplace that will be suitable?" The king takes the fish, how big he is now, maybe he needs help, and they take him over and they put him in a lake. And almost instantly, the fish grows and fills the entire lake. "My dear king, surely you won't keep me in this lake. This is far too small for a fish such as I." And the king said, "All right." And he gets lots of his men to help. And they take the huge fish and they remove the fish to the ocean. All of this happens in a day. And they put the fish in the ocean, and the fish turns to the king as he grows and says, "My dear king, surely you won't leave me here in this ocean with these fierce sharks and to mingle a fish wanting to eat me." And the king then bows down on his knees and says, "My dear fish, you are none other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You could be no other. No one could do these things as you've just done. Please have mercy on me and tell me how I may serve you." And the fish said, "Ah, very good. All the service you've rendered to me, you are my dear devotee. And I have a special task for you. I was only testing you to see if you would be worthy of the task at hand. And I see you are well, more than worthy." He said, "In 7 days' time, the entire world will be inundated by a flood, and everything will be destroyed. because it is approaching Brahma's night, and we are in store for the minor dissolution in the universe. So this is what I want you to do. A huge boat will appear in 7 days' time. No building required, no assembly required. It will simply appear. When this boat comes, I want you to fill it full of plants and herbs of all varieties. Number one. Number two, I want you to fill it full of species of all different varieties. Yes, if you want them to propagate, you'll need a male and a female, but that wasn't part of the story. Species of all varieties. And the third...
And that's why there's no dinosaurs anymore.
That's it, because they couldn't find... Didn't put it. Maybe they didn't show up for the boat ride. And the third thing I want you to put in is I want you to invite the seven sages of the universe. Every time there's a creation, there are seven sages who carry the knowledge. They are, if you will, the bearers of the knowledge that must be born, must be carried, Vedic wisdom, carried forward to the next creation. The seven sages, you will see them every night. If there's a clear sky, it is the Big Dipper. There's seven stars. Those are the seven sages. The Great Bear. The stars, according to the Vedas, are luminous beings, realized souls who become self-luminous. And that's who the stars are in the sky. Self-luminous beings. And, he said, it will be very, very dark and desolate. Dark and cloudy. There will be a heavy, heavy downpour of rain, a huge storm. And your ship, your boat will be illuminated by the effulgence, the light coming from the seven sages. That's how it'll be lit. So you'll be able to see. So, for the next 7 days, King Satyavrata said, as you wish, my lord. Yeah. Well, I didn't forget. So, for the next 7 days, the king sat in meditation on the fish incarnation of God. Matsya is his name. And Matsya means fish. And in 7 days, the rains began. And the boat appeared. It appeared. Didn't have to build it. And at that time, Satyavrata began to gather up all the herbs and plants and the animals and species and the seven sages and filled the boat. And then the waters rose, and the boat was on the waters, and off they went. But there was no fish. So Satyavrata, then on the boat, the sages said, now you must meditate on Matsya, on the fish incarnation, on Vishnu, so that he will appear. So he meditated, and finally the fish appeared. Now, you got to think that this is the inundation of the entire universe, not just the earth, right? The fish was 4
how much? 400. Anyway, he was 8 million miles long. 8 million miles long. That's long. But if you understand the level at which this is taking place, it's possible. And the boat was tiny in comparison. But what he told him to, what he had told him to do was, he says, the fish had a horn. Clint, he says, like a narwhal. Fish had a horn. And attach the boat to my horn using the serpent Vasuki, which is a huge, huge serpent. So Vasuki appeared and Setyavrat, or in modern parlance, Noah, attached the boat to the serpent and the serpent to the horn on Vishnu's nose, Matsya's nose. And away they went. For the entire duration of Brahma's night, 4 billion years, he spoke the Vedas. The Lord spoke the Vedas. The fish spoke all Vedic knowledge and sciences to Satyavrat and the seven sages. So when the deluge finished, Brahma's night finished, and the water subsided, then it was time for the new creation, the next version of the creation, 3.0, or whatever it was. And Satyavrat was made the manvantara of each creation. It's like the patriarch. Each creation has one person who is the patriarch of the creation under Brahma. And he's responsible for making sure population takes place. And that the Vedas and the knowledge is continued to be given to all the beings, to the people, to the beings in the universe, so that they can, improve their lot, make sacrifices to God, improve their lot in life, fulfill their desires, and get out of the material world, etc. So, he became the next Manu, Manvantara Manu, same thing. And his name was Vaivasvata Manu. So that's the story. And it is somewhat reminiscent of the Noah's Ark story, I'd say. This predates Noah's Ark by a lot of years, because many of the stories have come from Vedic sources. There's one aspect of when Jesus was born, heard that a king was born. Herod was king. Well, let's go find this guy and kill him off, because I don't want anybody to threaten my throne. And somehow they escaped. What happened? Who screwed up? Kill the firstborn male infant wherever you find in our kingdom. That was the edict given by Herod. When Krishna was born, Krishna escaped. Krishna was predicted to kill the evil king Kamsa. And Kamsa had killed all 7 of the children of Devaki, Krishna's mother. He killed them all. Even though the 8th one was predicted to kill Kamsa, he wanted to be safe rather than, killed all of them.
And the eighth one slipped his grasp, which I've told the story, but I won't get into that right now. And then he was told that the child is safe and living somewhere, and there's nothing you can do because this is providence, and you're as good as dead. You're the walking dead. It's a question of time. And so Kongsa wouldn't take that lying down, and he said, kill all the firstborn male children. So that predated Jesus' appearance by 3,000 years. Okay. So that's what we're talking about here, is the Vedic version and the Vedic source of really all cultures. In the Old Testament of the Bible, they often talk about people who came with the word and would make predictions, etc. And in Sanskrit, there's a word, avatar, which means that one who descends. But there's also another word, and that is prapat. And prapat in Sanskrit means, it's a verb, means to come down or to descend as well. And from the, if we anglicize prapat, what do we get?
Prophet.
That's this root prophet. So they'll say this prophet and that prophet for the Old Testament. And the prophets were going to prophesy what was to be done and what was going to take place and what God's will was, etc. So that's where that came from. And then another guy they talk about a lot in the Old Testament is Abraham. So if we take off the A, B-R-A-H-A-M, Brahma. Abraham is Brahma. So instead of H-A-M, it's H-M-A, Brahma. So that's...
Why do we not know more about the Vedic culture?
Because this is nicely explained here. After the Mahabharata war, which is when Krishna was on the planet, 5,000 years ago, the Mahabharata war killed off a lot of kings and warriors, kshatriyas, who were a burden on the earth. And that was why Krishna came, to get rid of these characters. He did that. But Krishna's leaving the planet also signaled the end of the Yuga, Dwapara Yuga, the Bronze Age, and therefore the start or beginning of Kali Yuga, the Iron Age. Correct? So when Krishna left, officially, the Iron Age began. Officially. At that time, many of the surviving people from the big war, the Kurukshetra battle, which is spoken about, that's the Bhagavad Gita. That's that battle. Their remnants of their civilizations and the different kingdoms splintered off east, west, north, south into Arabia, into Mesopotamia. Afghanistan at that time was still part of India, more or less. Up to the north, up to Mongolia, and you know, all these different areas. They went everywhere. And they had with them the remnants of the Vedic culture. But you'll know, if you go anywhere and you've studied any kind of languages, you'll see that the dialects, languages lose their purity and dialectical forms or what's the term? Can't think of it right now. You know, the common, more common form. What's the word I'm looking for? Colloquial. When the colloquial form gets used, you know, and you'll see this with any language, and it's the simplified, bastardized, watered down form of a word. So that's what happened. They went in their different directions, and these words and language got watered down. So did the culture and the remnant of the Vedic culture. So at that time, the whole history, they talk about history beginning at a certain point. The Western historians say history began at this point. Before that, we have no history. Why do we have no history? Well, the history is the Vedic history. That's it. But there's a disconnect made because all of these groups and cultures and peoples splintered all over. So what is explained is this. Another reason why many portions of history have been forgotten or buried is that it was typical of the conquering religions that make converts through military force. What is that? Religions. Crusaders and? The Christians are the Crusaders. And? Do the Jews conquer other countries? Do the Jews do that? And make everybody Jewish? I should think not. Do the Hindus do that? They conquer and make everybody Hindu? No. Do the Buddhists do that? No. Did the Shinto do it in Japan? No. So who does it? Muslims and Christians. Full stop. That's it. Muslims and Christians, right? That's what we're talking about. They make converts through military force and they destroy any historical evidence of the previous culture. Wipe it all out, lock, stock, and barrel. So there's not even a remnant. Do they not do this? Is this not historical? Especially when it displays loftier principles and more advanced levels of consciousness. When does it do that? In every case, when you're looking at Christianity and Islam. Sorry, it's a fact. Compared to these other religions we just mentioned. So, rampaging Roman, Christian, and Arab Muslim armies destroyed as much of any remaining Vedic culture they could. This, unfortunately, also helped plunge the world into what has been called the What Ages? The Dark Ages. Where did they come from, I wonder? Which included terrible crusades, witch burnings of thousands of innocent women. Oh, you four would have gone first. And intense torture of any so-called infidels. Correct? Dark Ages. Consequently, the teaching of the Vedic sciences suffered a severe setback. Much of the fish was not there at the time. This meant that the further development of society also ceased to progress and was forced to discover things all over again that were previously known and destroyed and repressed and sliced up and dug into a hole. Correct? This provided the basis of the glorification of the inventions and discoveries of such men as Galileo, Copernicus, and Newton. Oh, guess what we just discovered? Dude. It's been around for thousands of years. Well, I didn't see it. No, you didn't. Correct. They got rid of it all. These enlightened beings, these enlightened Christians and enlightened Muslims. So these Galileo, Copernicus, Newton, who were really discovering what the Vedic literature had described thousands of years before. Thus, there was a period of several hundred years, if not thousands, in which societies became more distanced from the Vedic culture. And they also became more backward and underdeveloped. In fact, in some distant regions, humanity sank to a state of primitive living. Interesting, huh? Do you believe that? Yeah, it makes complete sense. Okay. Even the story of the creation of the world, as explained in the Bible, has its roots in the Vedic tradition. In the first sentences of the Bible, it states, "In the beginning, God created heaven and earth, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters." So herein, we can see that the Bible begins with the same but summarized story as recorded in the Vedic texts. Because in the Vedic text, Vishnu lies down on the waters. And what is all around him? Nothing. It's empty. Nothing's been created. He's lying on Sheshanaga, serpent couch, on the primordial waters, on the Garbhadak ocean, the womb ocean, and Brahma comes out of his, or first the lotus flower comes from his navel, and Brahma appears in the lotus, and he goes, "I don't see anything. Everything is dark and void." So when Lord Vishnu was lying on the universal waters in a dark and empty universe and created all the universal elements to form heaven and earth. This is continued in the New Testament in the opening lines of the book of John, which states, "In the beginning was the
Word,
and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." That first word, as described in the Vedic text and related earlier in this volume, was what? Om. That's the word. The sound of the universe is Om. Aum. Aum. That's Om. Aum. A is creation. Ooh, ooh is maintenance. Is dissolution. Creation, maintenance, dissolution. Shortly after the creation, the Bible refers to the story of Adam and Eve, the first couple from whom the human race was born. However, this is similar to the previously recorded story in the Vedic texts of Swayambhuva Manu. So the Manu, the patriarch, this guy, the first guy's name was Swayambhuva, and his wife, Shatarupa. That's his wife. And his wife, Shatarupa, who, after coming into being, were essentially advised by Brahma, the creator, to beget many children and rule over the earth. "For you shall be the ruler of men." So the Adam and Eve is really the Manu and his wife, and go ahead and propagate. There's no sort of being tossed from the garden per se, and nobody got tempted by the serpent in that account. And the Trinity, of course, we've talked about that many times. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. Father, Bhagawan.
son, meaning children, all of us, Paramatma, Super Soul, God within the heart of every living being, and the Holy Ghost is Brahman, spirit moving within everything. Also can be compared to Brahma, Vishnu, Brahma, and Shiva, the three deities of creation maintenance. Brahma, creation; Vishnu, maintenance; Shiva, destruction. Mother Mary of the Christian tradition also reflects the Vedic goddess Mari Amma, where Amma designates mother, Amma in South Amachi. She's very famous, Amachi, mother. Amachi is probably like Amaji. They say Chi in the South. Even the Christian term Mater Dei, mother of God, is but a reflection of the Vedic term Matre Devi, mother goddess.
Why did Christianity
walk off? Maybe you got Krishna and why did they have that? And why did Catholicism knock out the woman, like the wife? There's no such a wife in Christianity.
Well, Christianity
knocked out the wife. Essentially knocked out women entirely, except Catholicism kept Mary.
Yeah.
But I think most of the Protestant and other sects of Christianity have nothing to do with any feminine divine being. The Jews call the feminine the abomination. So you know where they stand. And we know where the Muslims stand with women. If you can put them in a black tent and pretend they don't exist and let them walk six paces behind you, life will be good. Otherwise, there's problems. And don't let them drive, whatever you do. Especially with that thing over their head.
It might crash.
Yeah. So, none of those religions honor the divine feminine. I would even go so far as to say, honor the feminine. What to speak of, recognize the divine nature of the feminine. You know, Buddhism has they have the goddess like Tara, Kuan Yin is not Buddhist, Wan Yin, she's more Guan Yin is like it's not Buddhist, though.
Right?
I don't think so. She's, well, it's Chinese. Guan Yin. Yin is...
Yin and Yang.
Yin and Yang. Yin is feminine. Guan Yin. And Yang is masculine.
Ask a question.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's asking a question.
You can even make a statement.
well, because maybe you might explain this, because I'm making a four-handed cup, which will eventually be cast and stuff. But it would have been...
What does forehand mean?
Four-handed.
Oh.
It would have been a Druid time, so that would have been a couple of hundred years ago.
Oh, shall I read you that?
So I was chanting. I thought, okay, I'm going to be really intentional because it's Christmas.
It's to be used for christening?
It's a gift for one of my daughter instructor's grandson. So I thought, okay, I'll chant the Hare Krishna chant and I'll be all like, cool. You know, I'll be a bit like the woman who did the your painting. So it was chanting away, and then I was making the cup, and I was going, this feels wrong. It just had to stop, because it was like, They wouldn't have been doing that about 100 years ago. And
doing what?
Well, chanting Hare Krishna. Like at the time of the Druids, like Stone Age, Newgrange.
Stonehenge.
Yeah, it's all of that stuff. And I just stopped chanting. And yeah. So I wonder what happened around those years, because I tried to see myself as being Irish. I was going, why do I chant Hare Krishna stuff when part of me believes that it's true, and another part of my, is it my culture? Is it who I am? Is it?
Shall I?
Yes, please.
Their asses are all in that part.
Stonehenge and the Druids.
Oh, great.
Another place to consider in regard to its Vedic influence is Stonehenge, a mysterious place standing on the Salisbury Plain in Wiltshire. The name of Stonehenge comes from the Sanskrit Stavakunj. Stavan Kunj, sorry.
Stavan means stone?
Stubborn, which means meditational bower.
Oh, so.
Stubborn. Because, you know, the words get changed significantly.
Mm-hmm.
So stone is stubborn,
yeah.
Which is not stone. Too hard. Stown.
Yeah.
Stown. Because V becomes W and oftentimes. And that is, stava means, he says meditational. Stava is actually a prayer. And a kunj is a bower. No, a bower is an enclosure among trees and vines and creepers. But it becomes an enclosure. Yeah.
Probably
had yeah. Where you can go inside of it,
mm-hmm.
But it's all natural.
Yeah.
That's a kunj. Which means, the original name actually has nothing to do with the huge boulders standing there. A few miles away is the place known as Woodhenge. The Sanskrit equivalent of wood is vana. Vana. Forest. Like Vrindavana.
Oh, yes.
Forest of Vrinda. Pronounced as Bon. Oftentimes, Van is pronounced Bon.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, the Sanskrit name for the place would be Vanakunj, or Vanakunj, Woodhenge, meaning a forest bower. This provides some insight into the Sanskrit origin of the names ending with Henge. The Druids who are connected with Stonehenge were the priests who played a great part in social life in ancient Europe. The term Druid is a European variation of the Sanskrit term Dravid, Dravidians, who are the South Indians. One of the connections the Druids had to the Vedic culture is explained in this way. The European community called the Druids are ancient Hindu Dravids. Druids, Drawids. Dravid becomes Drawid. Drawid becomes Druid. The dictionary describes them as an ancient religious order in ancient Gaul, which is France, Britain, and Ireland. In the Irish and Welsh sagas and later Christian legends, the Druids appeared as conjurers and not as priests and philosophers. They are mystics. This is a clear indication that the Druids of Europe are the same as the Drauds of India. They are not racial groups. They are a religious group of priests and philosophers who are deemed to perform miracles through their chants and worship. Incidentally, it should be noted here that it is wrong to characterize the Aryans and Drawids as rival racial groups. They are not. They are different ancient Hindu communities, both well versed in Hindu religious worship, lore, and Vedic practice. They spread to Europe when the Indian Kshatriyas ruled the world. As in India, so in European communities, we come across the term Aryans and Druids. They are not exclusive to each other. Druids are a group professing the Arya Dharma. That is the Arya way of life. Arya way of life, Arya Dharma, means
a path of enlightenment, where you pursue a progressive spiritual path alongside whatever else you do in life, materially speaking. But the spiritual underpinning is most important if you're an Aryan. You are Aryans. All you are Aryans. Because that's what you do in your life. Hence, when the world says that the Europeans are Aryans, what it should realize is that the Europeans have been Hindus. The Druids, you know, Hitler tried to propagate the Aryan race. That's how you say Aryan. It's the same word, but it's Aryan. Aryan race. But he bastardized it or changed it to suit his own purpose by saying white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, you know, and this was the Aryan race. It has nothing to do with any of that. It has to do with spiritual culture. And the last thing you saw Hitler do was anything that even remotely resembled spiritual culture. And he took the swastika, one of the most auspicious symbols known to man in Vedic culture, and, you know, used that as the emblem of Nazism. What?
Where has he come across this?
Oh, well, he was an artist. So if he was an artist, he was a bohemian. So that means he's, you know, he's got his fingers in everything. He's busy studying all these different things, you know. Okay. The Druids, alias the Drawids, formed a religious group in that Aryan community, believing in and practicing the same Arya, or if you like, Arya, Dharma. The term Drawid, relates to the earliest of sages at the start of the Krita Yuga. Krita Yuga is the Satya Yuga, same golden age. The word Dra signifies Drashta, one of the original seers. Drasht means to see. While the latter syllable, Vid, that means to know. Relates directly to the knower or the sage himself, the knower and the seer, or the knower who sees, the seer who knows.
Of the Vid.
Yeah. Vid. Vid means to know. Okay. And from Vid you get Veda. Mm. Knowledge. Right? That's how it works. Thus, they are from India as also... Okay. The Asiatic origin of the Druids has long been an acknowledged point in the world of antiquities. It came from Asia. Mr. Reuben Burrow, the great practical astronomer of India, was the first person who, after a strict examination and comparison of their mythological superstitions and their periods, directly affirmed them to be a race of emigrated Indian philosophers. Yes, very good. And that's me, Druid Lawrence. Kidding. Not really, though. Okay. Somebody else says, these priests, the Druids, Brahmins of India, spread themselves widely through the northern regions of Asia, even to Siberia itself, and gradually mingling with the great body of Celtic tribes, Kalatoya people to the south of Kashmir, pursued their journey to the extremity of Europe, and finally established the Druid, that is the Brahmin system of superstition, in ancient Britain. Thus, I contend, was the first Oriental colony settled in these British islands. This is one guy's statement. Another guy says, I'm not giving you all the names. He says that the Druids are recorded in the Vedic literature as Druhyus, Druhyu, Druhyus. They were driven out of India in a number of campaigns by rulers of the 4th millennium BC, even by Mandatre, as early as 4500 BC. This is in agreement with the Druid tradition, which traces their origins from Asia as early as 3900
B.C. The Druhyus, who were from India's northwestern regions, were led back. Northwestern regions is Punjab, Gujarat, Pakistan, Afghanistan. That's northwest. Driven from India's northwestern regions, who were led back into the heartland by their king Angara Mandatri, or Angara. Mandatri drove them back out of the Punjab and into Afghanistan. Yeah, anyway, it goes on.
Ireland.
Saints and Scarpers? Ireland. Other parts of the British Isles also display much evidence of their being influenced by Vedic culture. The name Ireland is a mispronunciation of the Sanskrit term Aryastan. Arya. Arya. This is the place of the Aryans. Era. Era. Arya. Era. How much closer do you want? Stan means place. Afghanistan, Tajikistan, Pakistan, and Stan. Now he's saying Stan is like land. Meaning the land of the Aryans or the Vedic culture. Charles Valancy explains that the Druid religion of the Britons was founded on that of the ancient Irish, which was in great part that of the Brahmins. By no other means could the deities of the Brahmins have been recorded in the Irish manuscripts. If this is the case, this would mean that the pre-Christian manuscripts in England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland were all of Hindu, Vedic, and Sanskrit scriptures. He further says that Sir William Jones allows the Irish language great affinity with Sanskrit. And this is not the first time you've heard that. This means that much of the Irish tradition is merely remnants of the Vedic culture. So whatever happened to these great Irish manuscripts, Valancy notes, the Irish and Welsh complain of the devastation of their manuscripts by whom? The first Christian missionaries. By the Danes, Norwegians, and others.
The Danes camped here in this field.
This here is called Whitefield because the Danes came and all the field was covered in white tents. My historian wife. That's her there. My Aryan Irish goddess. This explains how the evidence of Vedic culture was systematically wiped out by Christianity in Ireland. You know, that's not the only thing that St. Augustine, what's the guy's name? St. Patrick drove out of Ireland was not only the serpents, he drove out all remnants of the Vedic culture.
Well, maybe the circle serpent thing is actually the fact that there was snakes.
Snakes are sacred in Vedic. Maybe that's who the serpents were that were driven out of Ireland.
No, it was actually the whole Vedic,
Because for St. Patrick's Day, in a window display, I wrote a question mark.
Pretty interesting, huh?
It's
a good book,
actually.
Yeah, it's great.
I'm almost done here. Okay, so systematically wiped out by Christianity in Ireland as well as the whole of Europe. Later, when scholars tried to collect such manuscripts and other evidence of the ancient European Vedic culture,
These attempts were also stifled by hostile Christian elements. The deities of the Irish were also the same as those of the Vedic Aryans, as explained in Valancy's book. Quote, the pagan Irish had most of the deities of the Hindus. Their altars still exist in Ireland under their names. By the mode of argument used by Dupuy, the Irish may be said to be Hindus. In the preface to the Prospectus of an Irish Dictionary is a list of 18 deities in common with the pagan Irish and Brahmins. It is worthy of remark that the two greatest rivers in Ireland, the Shannon and the Suir, are the names of the two greatest rivers in India, the Ganges and the Indus or Sindh. I don't know how he gets that exactly. The Euphrates in Babylon was named the Suir. The Suir is from the word Surah. Surah is a saintly person. The Surah and the Asura, demons and gods. Gods are also called the Suras. So that makes more sense than
maybe
your man's.
Has a different game.
I work for Shannon. And they work with the old Ugrain symbol.
Shannon. Well, it might be from Shun, peace. Shun. Anyway, speaking of the ancient Vedic temples in Ireland, Mr. Oak explains, near Killarney in the county of Kerry is an Ughado church. It has an imperfect Ogham inscription, obviously disfigured by Christian invaders, so they were working overtime. The deity's name inscribed is Soma, the moon, Soma, the elixir, of immortality. The Soma is the moon god. As in India, that was a Somnath temple of Ireland. It is currently looked upon as a church. Ugha in Sanskrit means sin, correct. And Do means Dave. Dave becomes Dave, becomes Dove, meaning God. Therefore, that edifice is obviously an ancient Vedic temple of Shiva, who is an absolver of a refuge, or a refuge from sin. The name Killarney, too, is Sanskrit. Kalarnav, in Sanskrit, connotes a fort commanding the sea or close to the sea. Arnav is ocean. Kila is the fort close to the Arnav. Ocean, in Sanskrit. Killarney. Kalarnav.
Kingdom.
One more point. The name Scotland itself is an English corruption of the term Kshatrastan. Kshatra, Scot. Kshatra is sometimes pronounced Katra. This means a land of Kshatriyas or warriors. Well, the Scots are certainly that. The administrators of Vedic culture. Therefore, from all this evidence, we can understand that much influence on the British Isles, which can still be seen today, came from India and the Vedic Empire, of which it was a part.
There
you go. Okay.
So much in that book.
Did
he just write it, or did he write it?
He compiled it from so much. You know, he gives all his bibliography in there. So a lot of work went into. What's nice about this is you don't have to read all those other books.
Mm-hmm.
He's read them all.
He's
done the thesis and compiled all. You know what's pertinent in this book. It's very exciting. I was going to go on more about the words, but it's good for now. Okay, shall we do a little meditation?
I can mention things, you know, they look at me like I've got four heads. I'm always puzzled why they don't know. Because not everybody is on the same wavelength.
They're on a different ladder.
It's like it's for a different few who have the information that you're...
Well, did you see the quote I sent you in relation to you in your last email?
Yeah, you said these people are very rare. So
I didn't say it. Krishna said it.
Krishna said so we're really rare.
You're rare.
And then that's the ego then thinking, I'm really rare, but I don't really like to think that I'm rare.
Well, you don't think that you're rare, you are.
You don't think you're rare in that you're better than others.
No.
That's what you don't do. But you need to also realize that you're in a position where you're aware of things. It's not just being aware of it. I mean, I could sit here and read the Bhagavad Gita to 1,000 people.
Yeah.
And most of them go, yeah, okay, well, what's for lunch? Or, let's go down to the bar. Yeah. Meaning, they wouldn't get it.
They haven't.
Correct. Yes. They haven't spent enough time purifying themselves.
Lifetimes.
Qualifying lifetimes. We're not talking like a couple hours here and there. You're talking lifetimes to get to this point, where when you hear this stuff, you go, "Wow, that's really interesting. That's really compelling. Oh, I believe that." Why would you believe it? There's a feeling you get it inside of yourself. You either get it or you don't get it. Somebody can't place it there for you. There's a feeling you get and you go, this is absolutely rings true for me.
It resonates
and I know it's true. And here's some proof, in this form. But we're not busy trying to prove to others. We're trying to raise our consciousness. That's what we're here to do. Sure, it's nice to help others, but I don't want to spend my life proving to non-believers and people who have no appreciation because they don't have enough sukriti. They don't have enough pious or virtuous activity throughout their lifetimes to be able to absorb something like this and get it. I can look you in the eye and you can look me in the eye and we go, we know what this is. We talk about it, we explain it, but we don't have to. Yet you either get it or you don't get it. And people who don't get it, maybe they will become awakened in this lifetime. Many of them won't. And they have to do enough virtuous, pious, charitable, kind actions, both toward humanity, other beings, and toward God, before they'll get to that stage. Yeah, you're one in a million. That's a fact. Very easy to say that. On the one hand you say, wow, I'm one in a million. On the other hand, only one in a million. Who can I talk to? Like you say, you're trying to talk to these people and they go like, their eyes glaze over.
It's exactly the same for me, Catherine, so you don't go there with those people.
Just let them walk.
You just don't waste your time. Because you have a better chance of losing them completely than ever introducing them to even the slightest little thing.
Do you talk with art? Do you talk about art to people who are in Croke Park on Sunday?
No.
Maybe there's a couple of people there who would appreciate art, but most of them do not care about art. Okay, you want to talk football? They're there. Happy to talk football. Especially over a pint or two. So, alright. Close your eyes, breathe, relax, let go. Deeply, deeply relax. Allow stress, tension, fear, apprehension to drain from your body. Totally, completely relax. Breathe and let go. High above, a beautiful beam of radiant pearl white light comes down, down, all the way down, entering through the top of your head, expanding throughout your head, torso, arms, legs, out the bottom of your feet, into the earth below. Breathe, relax, and let go. Alright. You're back in the time of the Druids. In Ireland or England or Wales or someplace. It's the period of the Druids. What do you see around you? How are the people dressed? What's going on where you are? Who are you? Are you male? Are you female? How are you dressed? What is your role? What is your identity? What is your job? What happens? What do you do? What is your objective? Let it unfold. What happened with your objective? Did you meet your objective? What happened in the meditation? Come now to a point of resolution as far as possible. Slowly returning to consciousness. Awakening, feeling refreshed, relaxed, and at peace. All right, my fellow Druids. Do you know that Drew means oak? And of course the sacred tree for the Druids is the oak tree. And the sacred plant is the mistletoe that grows upon the oak. And Kalindi's maiden name is Quirk. And quirk or quercus means oak in Latin. So the oak married the oak. And we had a bunch of acorns.
My obsession with acorns, yeah.
Jai Shri Krishna. Om Tat Sat.